And welcome back to The End of Religion, a podcast exploring the subversive spirituality of Jesus. My name is Bruxy Cavey. I am the teaching pastor at a church called The Meeting House in the Toronto area, and I am not alone.
Hey, it's Tim Day, senior pastor.
And we partner together in crime here at The Meeting House, and we're walking through the chapters of the book, The End of Religion. But some of you have written and said that you just listened to the podcast, you haven't gone through the book yet, and I'm glad it stands alone on its own. But if you are reading through the book, hopefully they'll complement one another, that we're not repeating the exact same information that's in the book and in the podcast. So make sure you get a copy of The End of Religion if this is something that...
Is resonating with you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And right now, this week, we're going to be talking through Chapter 8, Offense Around the Law. We're talking about tradition. Before we dive into that, Tim, let me tell you about some of the email that we got. Hey, thanks, everybody, for rising to meet the End of Religion email challenge. Last week, we asked you, if you're listening out there, even if you don't really have a question to ask or anything to say, just write in and let us know who you are and where you're listening from. And I really appreciate those people who wrote. We got a number of emails from all over the place, certainly across Canada, which is fantastic, but also south of the border. We've got some American listeners. I know south of the border means something different to our American listeners, but for us, you Americans are south of the border.
Our border.
Yeah, that's right. And also, though, it was fun to get an email from Janet in the UK and also Susan in Russia listening. Yeah, and good old Joel and the gang in Sweden are still tracking with us.
Hey, Joel.
Yeah, so we're glad you guys wrote. Let me just say again, if you're listening and even if you don't really have anything to say, just to fire us off a quick email and let us know you're tracking. We'd love it and where you're from. Again, write to... feedback@theendofreligion.org. It's all one word, feedback@theendofreligion.org, and let us know that you're tracking with us. We love to get the feedback. One person, Jamie from the States, he wrote and he asked, what's the difference between following Jesus and following the commands of Jesus? Because Jesus says, follow me, and I believe he says that many times in the Gospels. I think it's over 80 times or so, Jesus says, follow me, follow me. So we're following the person of Jesus. But there are those times that he talks about his commands. He says, if you love me, you will obey my commands. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, he says, this is what a wise man is like. The wise man is the one who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice, this teaching of mine. He talks about a man building his house on the rock. And then finally, at the end of his life, in the Sermon on the – sorry, not the Sermon on the Mount, at the Great Commission, he says, go into all the world baptizing them. So there's a command. Baptize them in the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and teach them to obey everything I have commanded you. So we can't escape the fact that there's specific things Jesus taught, whether they're called commands or teachings or whatever they may be. What's the difference between following Jesus and following Jesus' teaching or Jesus' commands? Now, my job is just to read the question, Tim. Your job is to answer it.
I'll take the first swing at it.
All right.
First swing. You know, first blush, you just take a quick look at the New Testament. You could say, yeah, here's a whole long list of commands. Let me fire off a few. You know, Jesus said, wash... each other's feet.
Yeah, that's right.
Paul said, greet each other with a holy kiss.
Mm-hmm.
There's commands around head coverings.
Yeah, Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me with the Lord's Supper. There's commandments.
There's commandments there. I'm not sure I want to greet you with a holy kiss,
no,
Brux.
No, you don't. I need to brush my teeth.
Yeah, but or wash your feet for that matter.
That's
but,
right. You kiss my feet. It gets all messy.
We want to avoid that. But okay. I think at first blush, you could say that. The thing that strikes me about Jesus is, when you actually drill into what he was teaching as his core commands, rather than expanding the number of commands or really detailing a lifestyle of adhering to commands, what he essentially gave was two key commands that we were supposed to teach. Love God with everything you have. Love others as you love yourself. Right. And it's essentially the commands. He said, it's almost tongue-in-cheek. You want a command? Let me give you a command. Right. Learn how to love each other. And we see this played out all through the New Testament. Paul, as he's walking along a church in Corinth that was really struggling with tons of stuff. Like, they were a messed up bunch of people.
Yeah.
What's fascinating about that is, yes, he was trying to give practical direction to them of how to sort that out. But at the end of the day, he says, you read this 1 Corinthians 13, all that really matters is love.
Right.
Look, you want to sort this out, you've got to get inside the heart of God's love and understand how to love each other.
So Paul gives a list of commandments, for instance, in 1 Corinthians 12, 13, and 14, to a church that's struggling with knowing how to use their spiritual gifts. But and Jesus speaks to his disciples about washing each other's feet, to learning how to love. We've got, and Paul says also to the Corinthians, here, women should wear these head coverings, and men should have short hair, and this is, but it seems as though the commandments that we see, what we could call commandments or teachings or rules in the New Testament, are not an independent hovering body of religious regulation that you can transport with you into any culture, into any time, and plunk it down and say, hey, here's the New Testament system, here's the New Testament body of law. But rather, Jesus says, you need to love God and love each other as you love yourself. Now, let me show you how that's done.
That's right.
And this is how, and so we are called to follow Jesus. And when we follow Jesus, of course, if we're following Jesus, we're going to listen to his teaching. We're going to listen to his commands. But his commands then are going to be situational specific.
That's right.
Culturally adjusted. Because love will get expressed differently in different cultures and different situations.
One of the great examples, it's a painful one that comes to mind, is Timothy. Mm. By and large, across the whole teaching of the church, is, hey, look, at now that you are free in Christ, the sign of circumcision.
Yeah. Oh, I knew where you were going.
Men having to be circumcised. You don't need to do that anymore. That's
right.
Not an issue.
Right.
It's what matters is your heart being circumcised, your heart being changed and set apart.
Right.
But then Timothy ultimately is circumcised so that the Jewish people are having just a real struggle with that.
Yeah.
Would have a chance to hear the message. And I think, man, talk about an act of humble love.
Right.
To, as an adult man, to be circumcised, even though you don't need to do that from any sort of religious code, you're going to do that out of love.
Yes.
So they have a chance to hear the message of Jesus. I'm like,
so here's the New Testament command.
He's a better man than I am.
Right, right. It's a great example. We're just making half of our listening audience uncomfortable. We're going to lose them. But it's true. So here's a command. You can say, well, there's a New Testament command. You don't need to be circumcised. But you can say, but here's a contradictory New Testament command. If circumcision will help you advance the gospel within a Jewish context, get circumcised.
Just to take that off the table so people don't talk about it anymore.
Yeah, so they realize that this is not just a anti-circumcision movement. We're actually talking about something deeper here. So what we realize is that what's called a commandment, if you want to use the same term in the New Testament, is actually not that independent body of religious legislation.
Right.
It is the outworking of the love ethic. It is saying, in this situation, since we are free in Christ and we don't have to do this, that, or the other, what would love look like in this situation? And there you see the teachings, the commands, if you want to call them, of Jesus. But as long as you're using the word commandment, make sure that you're understanding how that's nuanced when you're following Jesus as opposed to an Old Testament approach.
I think that's excellent.
Okay, all right. Well, Jamie, I hope that was helpful. And if not, well, tough Rocco. You used up your
email
questions.
Email us again, and we'll take another shot at it.
Yeah, that's right. We'll try again. So, all right, we've got the commands of the Bible, but what happens when we add to them, when we build up our own traditions? And that's what chapter 8 is about. Last week we talked about Christ's relationship with the actual Torah, breaking the rules. But now we're talking about trouncing tradition. Because it's true, Jesus was very hard on how they legalistically kept the Torah, but he was even more hard on how they added to it and created their oral Torah. Within a first century context, they had the written Bible, the Torah, but the oral Torah, or the tradition of the elders, were the centuries-long traditions that had built up over time. Now, they taught that they were given at the same time as the written Torah, that Moses had been given both the written Torah and the oral Torah, and they held both in equal esteem.
Yeah.
Jesus disagreed with them about that and said, look, let's face it, these are human traditions, and you guys are adding to God's message to you, and you're creating a heavy burden for people to bear. That's what tradition is turning into here, and there's so many applicable transferable principles to our context.
Yeah, I think it's great to be able to identify that this is a human tendency we have.
Mm.
That the Jews are struggling with something I struggle with, that people throughout the ages have struggled with. And that is, once you have a basic truth or principle you want to live by, that tendency or temptation to now build up this huge body of case law. What do you do when you do this? You know, what's the right, let's say if you work at in a business setting, how often do people within large corporations labor under and complain about the big, long list of policy that follows everything? Everything you have to do, you know, gets spelled out by policy. The temptation is for us as humans is we want clarity. Just make it clear.
Yeah.
Please, just tell me what to do and I'll do it.
Yeah.
Then we feel better that, hey, I have checked off my righteousness for the day or I've done everything I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
And because we want clarity, a lot of times how we answer clarity is actually by expanding on the basic truths or the basic
principles,
principles and we add up a whole pile of extra stuff that then, and in the early stages feels great because now I'm clear.
Yeah.
But down the road, it just becomes this huge, like you said, burden, this imprisonment almost.
Well, for that first generation that's working out what does a love ethic look like, they will flesh it out by workshopping it, by running through the love ethic a number of case studies, let's say. What does it look like when someone is a traveler in a country where their feet are dirty? Well, what do? Mm. You wash one another's feet. That's what the love ethic looks like. Okay, how about in a country where... or in a culture where a woman's hair is sexualized, and well, what do? You wear a head covering when you come into worship together, and so they're workshopping what it looks like. Let's work through these case studies, and so it's a labor of love to figure out what these illustrations or these commandments within that culture and that time would look like. It is an ongoing labor of love. But all it takes is one generation to come along after that and just inherit the framework.
Right.
And say, oh, these are the rules. We wash feet and we wear head coverings.
Yeah.
And it's not a labor of love anymore. It's actually just inheriting a new religious system. And we miss the point.
Exactly. As we dive into this chapter and look at the first page, I love where you talk right off the bat, use the phrase about the fence around the law as the title of the chapter.
Yeah.
And then as you're diving into this first, you know, page, you say, fences are fine for cattle, but sheep need a shepherd.
Right.
I love that point that you're highlighting there, because Jesus is challenging us over and over again to not rest on some sort of man-made or human-constructed code, but he's constantly calling us into relationship. Relationship with him as our good shepherd, but relationship with each other as we seek to be under-shepherds or shepherding one another, where we don't rely on that. The clarity doesn't come from, have I mapped out every extra rule that I need to make sure I'm miles away from doing something wrong? But that clarity comes because I'm in relationship and I have that sort of sounding board or that coach or that voice in my life that is helping me navigate the waters when I'm unsure.
And that's even, to work with that word picture, that's the difference between shepherding and ranching.
Right.
There's a large part of ranching that is just containing the cattle within a fenced area, bringing them the stuff they need, but for the most part, keeping them fenced in so they don't escape. And at least shepherding in the time of Christ, it wasn't about fenced in areas. They might have a sheep pen where they spent the night, but they were traveling together over areas looking for food and had to follow the shepherd, stay in contact with the shepherd, and the shepherd had to keep his eyes open for the sheep and whether there are any predators, whether all the sheep were there. And couldn't just leave that up to the fences.
Exactly. And I think in our context, just that image of the sheep and the shepherd is a great one for just us to pause on and think about. Mm-hmm. Maybe John 10, if you want to take a read of that the example of the good shepherd. What I love about that passage where Jesus is mapping out for us a type of caring spiritual leadership that helps people reach their best potential or to achieve the type of community that he's looking for.
Yeah.
The things you've highlighted. One is, he says in that passage about how they go for the lost sheep. They leave the 99, they go after one that's lost. Yeah. It's a great example of, you know, the love ethic pushes us to be open to exceptions. Yeah. Where the law or codifying everything by a detailed list of extra laws, there's no exceptions.
Right.
Right? If you're on the outside, you're on the outside.
Yeah.
And you're in trouble.
The law is the law.
Yeah. But here it says, no, actually, you need to be open to exceptions. Those times where you relationally say, you know what, this is generally what's good.
Yeah.
But in this moment, this person here, they're in a bad space.
Right.
We need to go to them and walk with them right where they're at.
Well, that's the love ethic. It is as though Jesus prefaces every commandment, every teaching with the phrase, all things being equal, here's what you should do.
Yeah.
And then teaching that things are rarely all equal.
Right.
And so part of the love ethic is keeping your eyes open to how things need to be navigated in specific situations. So traditions, though, are attractive to us. They were certainly to the religious people in Jesus' day, and they're very attractive to us to add to what Scripture is already teaching, what Jesus is already teaching, to do the thinking for us, I think.
Yes, yes.
Right? To... again, that first generation, it's a labor of love. That first generation, it's like, how can we flesh out, case study, the love ethic of Jesus? Future generations inherit the traditions. And not only are they not struggling to think it through for themselves, mm-hmm. but they're not loving and they're not thinking. They're just and we don't, we all know this. People who are listening to this, either themselves or have friends who would say, "I've grown up in a religious tradition. I don't even know what some of the stuff means.
Right.
I just do it. We've always done it since I was a kid."
Right. And, you know, if we go down this path, there's a thousand ones, if you want to talk about the history of the church in recent generations, where something very meaningful in the past generations just gets handed down, and generations later, like, why are we even doing this? I'll give you an example, Sunday night service.
Yes.
Sunday night service used to be the evangelism service.
Right.
Because that's the time when you can invite out your friends, and they're likely going to come out and they have an evangelistic message and have an altar call.
Right.
People would all come forward to the front.
And you know why Sunday evening as well for evangelism? I had read they started using Sunday evening services during the time that light bulbs were invented.
Right.
Right. Because what they could do is invest in a tent meeting. They could find electricity and they could invest in having a light bulb on in the evening. Which would be the attraction to the town.
Yeah, people is, well, you've got electricity.
Yeah.
This is cool.
Then they'd come. So they'd find the technology of the day to invite people out. So have a Sunday evening service. It's invented as and for that reason, it was an evangelistic invention, the Sunday evening service. Early church didn't have Sunday morning, Sunday evening. But when electricity came along, hey, here's a tool we can use. And it was right for its time.
Right for its time. And people loved it. So they all came out to this, check out the light bulb, and this is a cool community gathering.
Yes.
And great time to reach out to your friends, right? Yeah. Now it gets handed down years later. I'm as a kid sitting in my church growing up, trying to figure out, what in the world am I doing here? I want to be at home, to be honest with you. I wanted to watch some football or do something else. But I just knew I had to be at church.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but one huge meal – if you're getting a good buffet Sunday morning, you're getting a huge meal, that should be enough to get you thinking on how you need to go and apply it for the rest of the day.
Okay, I wanted to watch football. Okay, just an honest
confession. Yeah, right. You want to watch football.
But yeah, we didn't need two services. Everybody knew that.
Yeah.
But then you couldn't break from the tradition.
Yeah.
And again, what you're saying is here, you know, I think it's one of those examples where one generation is struggling. What does love look like? What does it look like to reach out? What does it look like to have an impact in our community?
They came up with Sunday evening services, and it was a labor of love for that generation.
Right.
And then a few generations later, let's just keep doing it because isn't this what you're supposed to do?
Here's a great example in the meeting house. Right now, we generally, aside from our warehouse, we meet in movie theaters.
Yes.
Right? And it'd be like our kids saying, well, the one thing is you have to meet in a movie theater.
Yeah, that's real church. Now, our kids will grow up thinking that's real church.
That's real church. So now all the movie theaters closed down. Everybody has big entertainment centers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And we're keeping open movie theaters so we can meet in movie theaters.
Right.
Right? Because, and that's ridiculous.
Because that's where God met us when we were young.
Right?
That's how it always worked. Yeah, exactly. Well, I don't know about you, but I know people are listening from a variety of church backgrounds, but I grew up in a church background where we called our Sunday evening service the evangelistic service.
Right.
Sunday morning was called the worship service. Sunday evening was called the evangelism service. So even our verbiage was a leftover from a bygone era, because truth is, any visitors who ever came Sunday morning. I mean, the majority of newcomers, Sunday morning was packed. If you want to have an evangelistic service, it was Sunday morning.
Sunday morning.
And Sunday evening, it was really just the faithful few who wanted to sing a bit more and get some extra Bible teaching. I'm not saying it didn't serve a purpose. I was one of those people who, you know, I didn't care about football. So I enjoyed my Sunday evening service.
Yeah.
But it was fascinating that we called it the outreach service.
Right.
So I could think, okay, and you mentioned altar calls. I can think of those. So they could have a time and a place to say we want to give people an opportunity to make a decision.
Sunday morning Sunday school. When it was originally invented, it was completely outreach oriented.
Yeah.
By later generations, it was completely discipleship oriented, had no outreach focus, and its purpose was lost. So you'd get a great teaching in your Sunday school, have a great Sunday morning message for discipleship, come back for Sunday night, have discipleship.
Yeah.
And all of those were originally invented as creative expressions to try to reach out to people and expose them to Jesus in a fresh, relevant way. And so this, I think, this practice of building traditions, when you look at, you know, one of the passages you point out from Isaiah, these people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain. Their teachings are merely human rules.
Hmm.
One of the things I think that is challenging is for us is when we get into this pattern of just going through the rote. You know what I mean? This was handed out. I'm just going through the motions, going through the motions. There was a reason for it back 100 years ago or 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. What happens, it does create a sort of vain sort of talk where we go through the motions. We're just saying stuff just to say it.
Yeah.
And it's not truly coming from the heart or out of a passionate relationship with God or for other people. Mm-hmm. We're just sort of going through rote. And And then God says, look, at you're worshiping me in vain.
Yeah.
You're going through all these motions, but you're missing my heart in the middle of it.
But some of these people who Jesus criticized as worshiping him in vain seemed like the most spiritually passionate people of his day. They were full of religious zeal. They would be the people who thumped the Bible, you know, metaphorically, their Torahs.
Right.
They didn't all carry a Bible under their arm, but they sure knew it. They had it memorized.
Right.
They would be the Bible thumpers. They would be the traditionalists, the religious conservatives, and they would be the first to criticize a sinner. And so you would assume these are spiritually mature people. These are the people who have a real passion for God. And these are the people with all of their religious tradition that they're passionate about, that they have great zeal for, that Jesus is saying it's vanity, that you're missing the mark on this.
Right. And I think that's the, you know, it's easy for me to go back into my own childhood and say, wow, I can see that as a kid where people were so, you know, passionate for maintaining the traditions of how we've always done church and so passionate. This is what holiness means. This is what it means to truly love God.
Yeah.
And it was always defending the traditions.
Mm.
I can see that. But I think maybe the bigger challenge for me is to ask myself today, how am I today tempted to bond with my own traditions, the things that are my cultural expression of taking the commands of love, trying to live those out, and ways in which I may be in an unhealthy way bond with them.
Yeah.
And this gets me to another point. As I start to reflect on that, it leads me to something else. You're talking about passion. One of the things that you observe in Jesus' relationship and challenge to the Pharisees, Sadducees, who are so passionate.
Yes.
One of the things that stands out to me is that traditions have a way of evoking emotion, that we don't defend them just because they're good ideas. Mm. A lot of times they're not even that great of idea anymore.
Yeah.
It's because we love them so much or we have an emotional attachment to them.
It's true. If we've grown up with a particular tradition or we have been converted under a particular tradition, we do have the ability to emotionally bond with it in such a strong way. It just feels right. You know, and yet we'll criticize, if it feels good, do it, whoever. You know, those are terrible ethics. But in some sense, religiously, we've got the if it feels good, do it ethic that says, how can it be wrong when it feels so right?
It feels so right. And it feels spiritual. It feels great.
Yeah.
It takes us almost to, I'll give you an example from my past. Christmas Eve service at my church growing up as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
We always normally sang out of a hymn book,
sang
along to the organ and stuff like that. But on Christmas Eve, we put these slides up on the wall and sang all the Christmas carols, had a candlelight.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? The slides are sort of cartoons. They're a little bit wacky, right?
Yeah.
But you know what? We always had nice food afterwards and the songs and the candlelight and everything for me, for our church, for our community. We loved that tradition.
Yes, and there's nothing wrong with that. Great tradition, wonderful tradition.
We loved it. Now, the first year somebody messed with that, everybody was upset.
Right. Because it wasn't just a fine tradition. It felt right.
It felt
ethically the way it should be after a while.
Yeah. And somebody, when they began the process of change, they're doing it for all the right reasons.
Mm.
They're saying, do you know what? This makes us feel great, but this is a great time for us to invite our friends. And the way we're doing it is just wacky to anybody from the outside.
Mm.
Right? So I think their heart was leading us as sort of shepherds of the church in the right direction.
Yeah.
But I realized, you know, I was, even as a kid, struggling through my own emotional attachment.
Yeah.
And so that leads us probably to another aspect of this fence around the law, these traditions, and to realize, to say, there is a healthy version of tradition, and there is an unhealthy version of tradition.
Right. It's good to point that out because tradition does have a place. The Bible speaks both positively and negatively about it. It is how we relate to tradition. If, for instance, in a family situation, family traditions can really enhance the family relationships, the family dynamic, if we're using traditions appropriately at certain stages throughout the children's life, for instance.
Right. And that those traditions have to be submitted to the love ethic over time. I'll give you one of our traditions. We love going to camp every year. Mm-hmm. And on the ride up, like weeks before, we get stoked about going to camp. I have Nathan, who's 11, Rachel, 9, and Josh, who's 5. Mm-hmm. We just love it. We love the camp we go to. We love the food. We love...
So this isn't sending the kids out to camp. This is as a family.
Whole family. We're going out
and you're
the beach,
camping
the
together.
Activities. Yep. We love it. So it's one of those traditions we look forward to every year.
Yep.
We anticipate it. We celebrate on the way there. We take pictures. We remember it. We talk about it on the way home. We love it.
Yeah.
Now, I can guarantee you by the time my kids are 16 maybe earlier, at least by 16, they're not going to want to do that.
Not necessarily. Right.
No, that's not going
to
be.
Or you're going to have to modify it somehow.
You're going to have to modify. We're going to have to change something.
Yeah.
And by the time they're 18 or 20, right?
Yeah.
It's off.
Then you can't pull them away from university or their job and travel to Europe for the summer and say, no, tradition says we go to camp as a family.
Right. So tradition has to be submitted to love or else it gets weird.
Yeah.
Right? Because what happens when I'm the dad who's trying to force the kids to relive these great memories.
Mm.
Right now, they're completely authentic, and they're reinforcing and cultivating experience of love.
Yeah.
But then as we move forward, love demands I adapt, and the traditions adapt. And what that means is those traditions, those patterns of how we do things, have to submit to a higher ethic, a higher vision of what it means to be relationship. Then my kids all of a sudden love me as a dad, not because I can just offer them traditions, but that we grow together and evolve together. And so I'll give you another example. My mom has been always doing the baking for our Christmas get-togethers for all of our families. We've gotten over years, great sticky buns, baked goods. We all love it. Do you know what? She's getting to that stage now where it's like, you know, that's too much. We can't do it the way we did. So you know what? Yeah. The kids are all starting to do some baking. We're all reinventing how we do it.
Yeah.
Why? Because we love each other.
Yeah. No, that's great. What a great example. At the end of the chapter, I believe I quote from Colossians 2:8. Let me just double check. Yep. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. We're just right now going through a series on the book of Colossians.
Mm.
And what's it called?
Christ in you.
That's right. Thanks. Yeah. And in the series, we're just working through chapter 2 and moving towards chapter 3, where Paul talks about these kind of empty teachings that at one time had a place, but now people have bonded with them and want to continue in them and want to teach every Christian convert to follow them. And in Colossians 2, just like in Galatians 2, 3, 4, well, actually all of Galatians, and in Ephesians 2 are places where Paul helps the church kind of grieve through what it means to let go of traditions that are not working anymore in order to build new family memories or to allow love to cause them to move into a new way of structuring their meetings or their community or their life together. So tradition, again, has a wonderful place to play in our lives. But if we sense either that the tradition itself has outlived its usefulness, or even if it's a fine tradition, but my relationship with the tradition has become unhealthy because actually I've stopped thinking it through for myself and I'm just letting the tradition do the thinking for me, then it may be time for a change. And tradition cannot be so sacrosanct that we're afraid to touch it, we're afraid to change it, whether that's a church to get family together saying, let's change our tradition completely, or it's a single individual saying, I need to change my personal tradition. Maybe it's the way I read the Bible, or it's a process of daily devotions, or it's some personal spiritual practice that I need to mix it up a bit because it's become a tradition that is slowly losing its meaning for me.
Yeah, I think in that challenge to us to constantly be open to hitting the reset button to get back to the essence and say, okay, what does God want?
Yeah.
You referenced the religious leaders of Jesus' day being called blind guides.
Yeah.
I think that's what happens on the other side of when you aren't aware, tuned into the essence of what Jesus is trying to teach. You become, in a sense, blind. You create blind spots where you, again, are just following through the rote, going through the ritual, going through the tradition, and yet you're not seeing, you're not getting what God's heart is, or even what the hearts of the people are around you, what their needs are.
Mm.
You're just sort of trapped in a rut. And I think for those of us who are in spiritual leadership, we have to be challenged with that warning of, you know, is what we are using in community to help move us forward, those sort of wineskins or those patterns, those traditions, is it really getting the job done?
Yeah.
And I think that's the beauty of Jesus' teaching to us, is he's constantly saying, do you know what? You've got freedom.
Yeah.
You've got freedom to hit the reset button. You've got freedom to rethink things.
Yeah.
You don't have to stay stuck in a rut.
Yeah.
You can adapt to the needs of your culture, whether it's being a Jew to the Jew or a Gentile to the Gentiles.
Yeah.
You also have freedom to adapt to the needs of individuals within your group where they may say, do you know what? Our group, I'll give you another example on the traditional side.
Yeah.
very sort of historic old-time church. Just, you know, if you say sort of laden with tradition.
Yeah.
New leader comes in, pastor comes in. he may discern, and I can think of one example, I won't name it, the most loving thing he could do is say, do you know what? I'm committed to 15 years at this place, and I'm going to lovingly teach Jesus. Mm-hmm. But it's going to take us 15 years to probably go through the whole process where we get free from this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the freedom he has to really look at those people and say, God loves these people. It's going to be a journey.
Yeah.
It's going to take a time.
Yeah.
So in that time, does he submit to those traditions?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
He's very careful how he walks
steps
it out.
Into their subculture to teach them from the inside of that culture.
Culture.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is the freedom that Christ gives us. We don't have to be the rebel revolutionary. He gets rid of everything immediately.
Yeah.
Nor do we have to just blindly adhere to things.
Right.
You know, Christ challenges us to have our eyes wide open and then be led by love.
That leads me to, at least this will be my last thought. You can have others, but I'm just thinking that a one final caution from my end of things might be those people who'd be tempted to take away from this approach of Jesus, that religion is the enemy, pure and simple, and we have to always do the opposite of whatever. Sorry, did I say religion? Tradition. Yeah, I do think religion is the enemy, actually, pure and simple. But even people, that's a great example. People can bond with a certain word, and someone else says, well, actually, I'm a very religious person.
Yes.
Oh, you are? Well, you shouldn't be. Actually, no, we have to listen to how they use their words and connect with their heart and respond person to person, heart to heart, not just words to words. So there may be someone who uses the word religion positively, and that's their tradition, and they're actually tracking with us. But that's not what I intended to say. But someone who says, you know, I'm taking away from this, that there's such freedom in Christ to oppose tradition, that I will always see any church tradition or any church that seems to repeat the same pattern as somehow being unspiritual. Mm. And I'm in the name of Jesus going to oppose church tradition, period. And they would be missing the point, because really they bonded with their own tradition. They have a tradition of opposing tradition, whatever it is.
Right.
And they're not stopping to actually practice the love ethic of Jesus. So I hope that, because a teaching like this can always appeal to the rebel in someone who's actually not trying to love more. They just want a spiritual excuse for the rebellion.
Yes.
And so I would want to encourage people to say, no, this is actually a freedom to be more loving, not just a freedom to be rebellious against tradition.
Yeah. You know, just as you're saying that, I was thinking about, you're talking about it being freeing, this image of having your eyes wide open to see. In Jesus' teaching, I think there's this freedom to see the truth clearly, to see what love really is, but as a result of that, to see people and to not be blinded by tradition, where your eyes are always fixed on the ritual and the routine, but you're able to break those things apart and actually look and say, okay, these are the people, this is what their needs are, this is where they're at, and how do I love them? I think about the woman caught in adultery, you know?
Yeah.
Their perspective of law, of Torah, led them to totally not see her at all.
Right.
She didn't exist.
It wasn't about her.
It wasn't about her. And I think there's another way where you can look on the other side, where the Apostle Paul, before Jesus approached him, right? He is this legalistic Pharisee who's trying to kill Christians.
Yeah.
And I bet you if I was there as a Christ follower, I wouldn't really see Paul either as a person.
Right.
Yeah, Christ appears to him and says, do you know what?
Hmm.
You know, I love you and I want to use you.
Yeah, that's right.
And there's something about breaking off the traditions, breaking off our just blind attachment that says, you know, you're free. You're free to see people for who they are. Mm. If they need somebody who's a little bit more traditional, chill out. Meet with them right where they're at.
Yeah.
If somebody needs greater freedom and a totally radical approach where you're like, hey, you know, we're going to be totally non-traditional. We're going to hang out in a bar and sit down and have a beer and talk about Jesus. The beautiful thing is we're free.
Yeah, that's true. We're free to be traditional if that's a choice that we want to make, as well as being non-traditional. We're not threatened by either.
It's ultimately what's at God's heart, and how does Jesus' message best service the people that we're with, and how do we help them grow closer to Christ in that experience of love and growing closer to each other in that experience of love and to enter into that freedom.
That's great. Well, Tim.
That was fun.
That was fun. I think we've arrived at the end.
We're done.
We don't have an ending. I guess our tradition is not having an ending.
Yeah. Just remember to email us. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, feedback@theendofreligion.org. Thank you very much for listening.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.